And welcome back to the sixth episode of Punchlines in Politics. Once again, I'm Josh.
And I'm Braden. And today we have another special guest. You've seen him before. It's Ethan Langan. What's up, Ethan?
I'm doing good. How are you guys?
Hey, we're doing good. How about you, Josh?
Doing swell. I am swell.
No one has used the word swell in like 80 years.
So today, we are not going to be running the podcast. Today, Ethan is going to.
That's right.
So something that he is very passionate about is environment and government and how that kind of mixes together. Mm. So he's come up with some things that he's going to ask us, and we're also just going to have a conversation about, you know, what that looks like. So, Ethan, go ahead.
All right. Well, to start off, I wanted to ask you guys what you think the government's role in the environment and the environmental protection should be.
That's a good question. Brayden, you want to start or you want me to?
It's a chunky question. Why don't you go ahead and start? I have to do some thinking.
All right. Well, I mean, just as a start, I do believe that the government has a role, because the government is technically the owner of, you know, most of the land. They provide the energy and stuff like that. So the government has a role in the protection and, like, in not really in the United States, but in Africa, I know the government is using military to protect their, you know, endangered species and stuff like that. So I believe there is a heavy role for the government to play. The line gets gray onto what that means and what that doesn't mean, but I think the government does have a healthy role in how to protect and engage its citizens with the environment.
All right.
All right.
I guess me next. So as far as the government's role in, like, the environment, like protecting the environment and stuff like that, I have to say I'm a little bit more laissez-faire. For those of you who don't know what that means, number one, you're stupid. Number two, I didn't mean that. No. Laissez-faire basically means, you know, hands off, the government stays away from kind of stuff and just kind of lets, you know, in my opinion, lets the free market do its work. So that's kind of where I am a little bit. I mean, obviously there's some things that I believe that the government needs to be doing as far as maybe inciting protection or at least doing a good job at, you know, making its citizens want to protect the environment that they live in. I feel like that an overbearing of government can never be a good thing. And even when some say it's necessary, I would say that that's pretty dangerous. For this specifically, though, I would say that I believe that if the government is going to have any kind of power as far as the environment goes, I would say that they definitely need to inform, you know, businesses and citizens about the dangers of what they might be doing to the environment, or at the very least, informing and educating and encouraging the safe and careful protection of, you know, certain elements of our environment. So as far as like, oh, we don't want to be over polluting our air, well, that's great. Let's incentivize states and businesses to, you know, stop utilizing things such as like coal or fossil fuels that would, you know, pollute our air, things like that. I would say that if you incentivize that, then it would allow for the free market to kind of adjust itself. And so slowly we become a society that freely becomes one that is more comfortable and honestly protective of our environment. So I would say for me, government, I think, should be pretty laissez-faire, except when incentivizing the, you know, well-being of the environment.
Those are two very different and interesting takes. So, Braden, you did, Braden, you did bring up one of the topics I wanted to touch on with, you know, the use of fossil fuels and stuff. So I guess we'll start there. It's one of the more, you know, heavily debated issues around the environment, especially in the United States. But I guess I'll just start off giving just a bit of background information and then, you know, leading that into the discussion. So the United States is very heavily reliant on fossil fuels such as coal, oil, natural gas, you know, stuff like that for, you know, power products like plastics and heating, all that type of stuff. Now, the thing with using the fossil fuels, though, is that burning them, which is what we do for power and heat in particular, releases a, you know, the molecule carbon dioxide. Because, I mean, that's all it really is. It's compressed carbon. That's all that fossil fuels are. And, you know, when we burn them, it binds with oxygen molecules from the air and creates carbon dioxide. And, you know, carbon dioxide is one of the primary factors of global warming. It makes up about, if I remember correctly, about 16% of greenhouse gases. And, you know, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but, you know, if you keep in mind that 70% of greenhouse gases are water vapor just from, you know, natural water cycles and stuff like that, it's a fair chunk. So the main issue around the use of fossil fuels is, you know, if humans are overly dependent upon fossil fuels for heating and power and electricity, you know, we keep burning it and it keeps pumping more and more carbon dioxide into the air. There, you know, there's this imbalance then. There's way more than there used to be, and it leads to what was originally referred to mostly as global warming. Now it's more so referred to climate change. But, you know, just the rapid increase of the average global temperature. So if I remember correctly, the past like 5 or 6 years, maybe longer, every year has been the record hottest year globally. You know, every year, the average temperature is increasing more and more. I don't know off the top of my head by how much, but it's getting to a noticeable point where, you know, ice formations at the poles are, you know, gradually reducing in size. The northern temperatures are getting warmer and warmer, you know, that all that type of stuff. And, you know, the big issue with that is that it is, you know, this increase in temperature across the globe is really dangerous for wildlife. So I believe it's predicted that if, you know, no further efforts are made to reduce the output of carbon dioxide into the air due to the use of fossil fuels, that the global temperature will increase it will increase by 1.5 degrees Celsius by, I believe it's 2050, maybe a little bit after that. Don't remember the exact statistic, but, you know, if that were to happen, if the global temperature were to increase by 1.5 degrees Celsius, I believe, you know, I'm taking these from several classes that I've taken as well, a few papers I've had to read for those classes, all the numbers I'm getting here. But I believe that puts about 80% of all bird species, 60 to 70% of all amphibians, I believe around 40% of all reptiles, and 10 to 20% of all mammal species at risk of extinction. So, that's a pretty big number, right? I mean, the bird statistic in particular, 80% of all bird species across the globe, you know, could go extinct just from this increase in temperature. And I mean, that's largely due to a lot of the further impacts that would be from it, you know, changing habitats, and rising sea levels, changes in seasons, stuff like that.
Just to jump in real quick, for the listeners who care about the exact number, the global temperature is rising by 0.1 or 16 degrees Fahrenheit, 0.1 Celsius or 16.16 or whatever it is, degrees Fahrenheit every year. But in Celsius, it's 0.1 degrees per year since the 1980s.
Yeah. So thanks for those numbers there, Josh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, with that bit of background information, I just wanted to ask what you guys think, you know, what should governments do to, you know, try and either, you know, reduce or full stop our use of these fossil fuels for carbon emissions? Or do you think they should do anything at all? Do you think they should be, you know, implementing laws and regulations, or kind of look like what Braden said earlier, should they just be trying to incentivize for this? And I got one more point to make, I guess. The majority of this carbon output into the atmosphere is from large corporations. You know, the everyday person does, you know, output a little bit with, you know, like cars, heating, stuff like that. But, you know, they, a one person or one family, they're not going to put out in their lifetime anywhere near as much carbon as, you know, a company that's mass producing stuff. So, you know, what do you guys think government should do about it, if they should do anything at all?
I'll let you take this one first, Braden.
I was hoping you wouldn't say that.
I mean, I can go first if you want me to.
No, it's cool. I'm going to go ahead and say this up front. I am not an environmentalist. My expertise is nowhere near the, you know, in the environment, or, you know, even that scientific element of, you know, in environmentalism. So I'm going to say that the things that I say, although they are, you know, I base them upon facts that I've come across, and just my own personal, you know, my own personal experiences. I just want to put that out as a disclaimer, is that I'm not educated in that realm. I'm more educated in the government realm. So I will say, I mean, I kind of have to say the same thing that I said, you know, previously. Like, it definitely, obviously, like, I don't like how our world is, you know, becoming increasingly, you know, warmer, and that a lot of this, you know, global change, global climate change is, you know, affecting our, our temperature, our environment, our, you know, even the animals that live in our environment, you know, that really disturbs me. However, I will say is that I'm pretty sure, that the carbon emissions of places like China and India and things like that, those places, like, they are incredibly higher than the United States. Now, do I think absolutely those governments? Yeah, and you know what? Part of that also, you know, part of that is also credited to the amount of people that live there. But, you know, the United States has the third most amount of people out of any other country. Like, before the U.S., it's, I believe,
it's China and India.
China and India, exactly. China and India. So I would say that definitely has an impact. But as far as, you know, the list goes, I'm pretty sure the U.S., although maybe they're in the top 10, I don't think they're number three, if I remember correctly. Like, okay, disclaimer again. I took, like, an environmental science class my senior year, which was, like, 3 years ago. So, no, I don't really remember a whole lot about that stuff.
Can I jump in with a fact real quick, though?
Yeah, go for it.
So I will say I do agree with your point that America is not as high as those other two countries. The main one is coming from China. I will say, however, that a lot of that can be accredited to America through outsourcing. People like companies like Apple, you know, all those big manufacturing companies do a lot of their manufacturing in China. So you could say America isn't as high, but we are still technically responsible for some of it.
But I'm not necessarily saying that we're not responsible for it. In fact, quite the
contrary. Oh yeah, I know.
I'm just saying that the U.S. is a government just, and it's a country just like any other country. I mean, it's going to outsource. You know, how many countries outsource? Every country outsources. Every single country outsources.
Now, does China outsource?
Some more than others. Yeah, they have. China does have a lot of imports. A lot of imports, you know, just for the fact that they have a lot of exports, they have a ton of imports. Mostly it is food-based imports because their agricultural structure is declining. So they are importing a whole lot of, you know, food and food products.
This is off the point. Go ahead. Keep going.
But what I'm saying is that, like, even agriculture, that also, you know, goes into that also goes into your carbon footprint. I mean, you figure all of the emissions that are coming from, you know, livestock, machinery, factories, things like that. I mean, agricultural and food sources are major sources of, you know, carbon emissions in any country. So I don't necessarily think that outsourcing has too much to do with that, because it all depends on the status of your country as far as agriculture goes, as far as industry goes. And so, yeah, I would say that, you know, outsourcing, it plays a role, but I would argue that you can't exactly make that argument and say that, oh, it's because, you know, America outsources. Well, yeah, like everyone does.
But, yeah, I would agree with you.
Yeah. So moving on from that, I mean, again, like I think all of this can be attributed to a lack of incentive to do anything about the environment. I mean, the easiest and cheapest way to make products and to increase GDP is through fossil fuels and, you know, coal, oil, etc. I mean, that's just the way it is. That's the cheapest and most accessible way to produce a lot of stuff. And so I would say, yeah, that's an issue. But why do you think that, you know, some countries are, you know, some countries have a lot of environmental policies that prohibit the usage of, you know, large quantities of fossil fuels and things that usually produce more carbon emissions? You know, it's not exactly, you know, healthy for a country to be just like, it's not healthy for a government, in my opinion, to take that control and say, no, you just, no one can do this anymore. That's the end of the story. I think it's better for a government to utilize the funds that are given to them by the people in order to give it back when the people do something that benefits everyone. So subsidies, tax cuts, things like that, those kind of things to encourage businesses, and then even states, like talking about, obviously in America's case, you know, incentivizing states to basically incentivize their own businesses to use more reliable, well, not necessarily reliable, but more, you know, eco-friendly sources of, you know, fuel. So that's just the way I see it. You know, it's just being more creative as far as what the government is doing rather than just putting a roadblock.
Yeah, I see where you're coming with that. If you're done, I'm going to jump into my thing. If you had something else you want to say.
No, that was basically the gist of my gist.
Okay.
Mind if I jump in really quick here?
Go for it.
Yeah, so just to make sure I'm getting your point right, Braden. So you would say that the government putting, a penalty or ban or something on, a certain company producing X amount of carbon dioxide in a year is a much worse choice than, say, if they use less than X amount of, if they produce less of X amount of carbon dioxide, then they get like a subsidy or a tax credit or something like that. Is that correct from what you were saying, Braden?
Yeah. Instead of, just putting a ban, incentivizing.
Okay. I just want to make sure I, got your point correctly.
Yeah, that was basically what I was going for.
All right. And then, Josh, you want to go ahead?
I want to start mine off with a similar disclaimer to Braden. My expertise is also in government and law and stuff like that. I'm definitely not a, high level environmentalist. However, I do consider myself, pretty well informed. I am roommates with a environmentalist expert. So, I tend to have, like in the very first episode, we talked about how I was a little bit more of a moderate left. And with that, I tend to have a more extreme view on, environmental protections and stuff like that. So, Ethan, to kind of paraphrase your question, make sure, because that was a little while ago and I can't exactly remember, you wanted me to talk about what changes I think could happen or what could help.
Mostly, what do you think the government should do about, this increase in carbon emissions and climate change? What do you think they should do? Should they do anything at all?
Okay.
Basically, along those lines.
So I'm going to go 180 from Braden and say that I don't think incentives are the route, because this isn't just an American thing. This is a global thing. And like, where I see the merit to his idea and that it could work, having people work to try and be lower, getting rewards from that, I think that would work on a American basis. And that's, I think, where your whole idea was. But my whole thing is that this is going to affect everyone. I'm a believer that, this is leading up to something that could cause a lot of death and destruction, kind of like what Ethan was reading about earlier. And with that comes the responsibility to take drastic change. Because, yes, we have individual rights and liberties and rights as organizations, but where do our rights end and the rights of, keeping the planet alive begin? Because, yes, we have an amazing, American way of life where we have the freedom to do whatever we want, but that's not going to matter if we don't have a planet left to live on. And so my view is that, I would say, Ethan, correct me if I'm wrong, but like 8 out of 10 scientists agree that we're heading towards a destruction level of pollution and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, the specific statistic last that I saw, which was about a year ago, is that 93% of climate-specific scientists, so people, scientists that specifically study the climate and how it's changing, 93% of them agree that, climate change is a massive issue that is the direct result of human activity and which will eventually lead to mass global destruction of, all sorts of species, plants, animals, humans, everything.
Yeah. So, 9 out of 10, I would say that we're at a point where drastic measures need to be taken. What that would look like, I'm not exactly sure. Like I said, I'm not an environmentalist. I don't know what would be banned and what wouldn't. But I will say that I do see a merit in providing, governmental aid to that, like kind of what Braden said, but modified in a way of that we know that you're having to do this, so we're going to help provide this, and this to help you in that transition. Something to help corporations so they're not shell-shocked from that, because that could topple a company, even one as big as Apple. But I think that we're at a point where it's no longer about the individual rights, because it could kill everything. and no one has like the triumph or trump card over all of life. So that's kind of my thing. Brayden, if you want to rebut me at all, you can. Brayden?
Sorry, I was looking at something else. What was that?
I was saying if you want to come back against my point at all, you can.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. I would just very briefly, I would like to quickly touch on something. So you say that my kind of view would mostly probably only work for an American, you know, style of government. And I would agree with you because you're absolutely right. The American, our Constitution is so well thought out that it limits our government in a way that, you know, prohibits it from doing anything that would, you know, overcompass or at least be an overreach of power to the point of where the people have no say, right? And so in some cases, you know, I'm not going to mention any, but like in some cases, a complete ban, a sudden ban by, you know, a president or legislature can be, you know, unconstitutional and therefore void. So yeah, I would say that that would my kind of view on that would work in an American culture, but probably not in some others. I totally agree with that. And to that point, I also want to make the, you know, insertion that we as an American government have this little thing called sanctions, which are nice, which are really nice when dealing with countries who are doing something that impacts more than just themselves, right?
I think the best example of that is North Korea.
Absolutely. I mean, the amount of sanctions that the U.S. has on North Korea, I mean, is outnumbered, right? Like, you can't even...
Astronomical.
It's an astronomical amount of sanctions for this and that and whatever. You know, one, for being a, you know, a tyranny that is, you know, literally starving out their population.
Actively trying to nuke America?
Actively trying to nuke the world. I mean, when is North Korea not at, you know, a cold war with someone? But that's my point, is that, like, if the U.S. was going to do something so radical as incentivizing, you know, more sustainable and natural sources of fuel and energy to the point where we don't have to use or have to rely on fossil fuels for the majority of our energy production, then, yeah, once we kind of walk the walk, we can talk the talk, right? Like, we can be like, all right, UK, guess what? You're not doing, you're obviously staying in this cycle of, you know, fossil fuels and, you know, carbon emissions, and, you know, you're not trying to get any better. And so that's not only hurting you, that's hurting the entire world. Therefore, we're going to put sanctions on you until you can kind of come to your senses and be like, all right, maybe we should actually, you know, actively try and avoid, you know, mass earth destruction, right? Like, and so obviously that's radical, right? Like, that's the last thing that you want is for the U.S. to sanction someone over that. So I would say, you know, at the same time, you mentioned this aid. Like, if America had the money and the you know, the products in order to aid another country who might want to start to be less dependent on fossil fuels but don't have the resources or the means to do so, that would be a point where the U.S. can say, okay, let's go ahead and help them out with that. Like, we have, like, we're doing well. So let's go out for the good of the world and for the good of America as well. We can go to them and say, all right, here is aid for you to start doing this. start doing it, right? Like that's the one, that's the wonderful thing about being a world power, is that you have the ability and the influence to do that in most places. The issue is that a lot of countries aren't doing that for the betterment of the entire world. They're doing that for the betterment of their own country. So you look at, you know, China, and they'll probably they'll probably put sanctions on, well, not sanctions, but they'll probably give aid to countries that better their own production, right? And their own
Vietnam.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, it's a difficult position, because obviously on one hand you want things to get better for the globe, but on the other hand you have corrupt politicians and corrupt governments that will not allow for something like real environmental change to happen because of their, you know, bullheaded agendas that, you know, they're not willing to overlook that in order to kind of maintain the earth that we live on.
You heard it here first, folks. Braden is calling for an overthrow of the government.
No. We're actually.
So, Ethan, this was kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but I am interested in hearing both your response to ours and what you would do, you know, as someone who I would consider an expert in environmental matters.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite say I'm an expert, but I am pretty knowledgeable. I study
modest.
Yeah,
you're modest, bro. You're an expert.
I study zoology, you know, study of animals. And with that, I take a lot of biology and environmental based classes, and a number of my classes like to go really in depth into this stuff. I'm currently taking a class specifically about environmental issues and, you know, conservation, all that type of stuff. All right. So Braden, I do agree with you a bit. I do think that, you know, incentives and stuff like that is a really good thing to do, especially for like corporations and stuff like that. And I do also agree that an outright immediate ban is not the right way to go. I mean, that just doesn't work. If you're asking people to immediately switch from one, you know, system to another, it's just way too expensive as an upfront cost to do it. Pretty much every company would go under. So I do agree with those points. However, more generally, I agree more so with Josh's points. You know, I do believe this is a very large global issue. It's, you know, not restricted to the United States, though we are more specifically talking about the United States government because it's where we are. But, you know, this is more of an international global issue. So what I personally think should be happening, and it is starting to a little bit, is that the, you know, the UN should put in these regulations and guidelines that they expect countries to work towards in order to decrease emissions of carbon dioxide from every country. And then it will be the country's responsibilities to implement, you know, laws and programs and other such things to get to that point. So from my understanding, what the real thing that needs to be done majorly is a switch in how we get our energy. You know, right now it is, especially in the United States, majorly from fossil fuels, not a whole lot of green energy. However, renewable energy sources, such as, you know, solar, geothermal, hydropower, wind power, stuff like that, we don't really have the infrastructure needed or the technology advances needed to rely exclusively on those. It's just not there yet. The technology's not there. We just don't have the ability to do that. What we do need to work towards more so, though, at least in my opinion, is a larger shift towards nuclear power. You know, nuclear power is not—it's not considered a renewable energy source because there is waste, and it's not an infinite energy source, if technically, because there's not a natural, you know, resource for it that will, you know, always come back, like solar, wind, stuff like that. But it is green. And so, like, you know, basically what that means is it's not producing any major, massive amounts of detrimental waste. Now, the waste of nuclear power is radioactive and toxic. However, if disposed of properly, it's really not that hard to contain. And it doesn't really produce all that much comparative to how much energy is put out. And from my understanding, the big issue with that right now is getting the infrastructure set into place to where we can rely majority on nuclear power as these more renewable energy sources are advanced more. And one point I would also like to make on those renewable energy sources is that they're not all equal, you know, in what they can do, what they're capable of. Wind power, honestly, is pretty bad as far as energy goes. Wind turbines are not great. They require large open spaces. And so a lot of times that means they, you know, take over an entire grassland or field, or they cut down a forest to put them there. And that's not great. They also don't have the best functionality. If they break, they don't really get fixed easily. And a lot of the parts are not easily recycled. So wind power, not fantastic. Hydropower is a little bit better. Although the major issue with that is that it does disturb natural streams and rivers. However, there are scientists working on trying to get workarounds to that. The main one would be solar energy, which is actually pretty good, and the technology for that's only getting better. So, you know, in my opinion, what needs to be done is countries need to be pushed to move towards nuclear energy, and then what I would suggest after that is solar.
Yeah, I see that. I've heard a lot about nuclear power. I've been reading a lot about how and why people are opposing it. Just because, you know, it's something I only recently heard about. Do you mind explaining geothermal power just for some people that, you know, may not be well aware? I mean,
yeah,
the other ones are pretty common, but geothermal is something that isn't as common.
Yeah, so I'm not the most well-versed in geothermal, but I do have a decent understanding of it. So from what I understand, it basically geothermal power, it uses the heat from the earth and uses that to produce heat and energy. The form that I'm most familiar with is geothermal heating for houses. And so what that looks like is they put this structure in the ground that basically it flows water through it. It's a system of piping, flows water through in a specific way. And so what it does is as this water is moving through the pipe, it absorbs the heat from the earth. And then it goes past a piece of technology that is able to utilize that heat to make energy, and that which is then used to heat the house.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact ins and outs of it like I do the other stuff. It's not a very large, you know, massive source of green energy. It's a lot more of that, like, individually based stuff. And I do know that tends to get fairly expensive, and I don't know exactly how efficient it is. I would guess on a large scale, not very. But, you know, more on the individual scale, apparently it's good enough for like a family or something like that.
Yeah. I just wanted you to explain, you know, just the pure basics of it, just for people who might be like, what in the world?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't, like I said, I'm not the most well-versed in it, but you know, if anyone's interested, absolutely look more into it and see for yourself what it looks like.
Mm-hmm. So moving right along, did you have another topic you wanted to discuss?
There's so many. I'll go with one that I am personally very passionate about. I am passionate about climate change, but I'm more so passionate about this topic, and that is the loss of biodiversity across the globe. And biodiversity just refers to the number of different organisms that live on the planet. It refers to different things like genetic diversity, which is, how genetically similar some things within one species are. There's species diversity, which is basically the total number of species that we have. And that's one that's mainly in focus here. I guess we'll go into the global loss of, wild lands and biodiversity. In the last 50 years, we have lost 60% of the world's biodiversity. So that means in the last 50 years alone, 60% of all life, like all species on the planet, have been wiped out and they're never coming back.
Dang.
And that's due to, it's due to five primary factors. One that we've already touched on was the climate change. Another very large one is habitat loss. So the destruction of their habitat or, some other different forms of that. Pollution is another big one. I know hunting is one major issue. And invasive species is another issue. I guess I'll briefly touch on all of the other topics other than climate change. Pollution, fairly simple. Putting dangerous substances into the wild. And that can be chemicals, trash, anything like that. A lot of it is chemical waste and chemical pollutants that those do a lot of damage. And then another big one is plastic as far as like trash goes. And those in one way or another detrimentally impact the health of the organisms that live in those polluted areas. Then there is habitat loss, which, like I briefly said, is the destruction of natural habitat. That can happen in a few different ways. One is just straight up destruction. We go through, cut down an entire forest. That's one form of habitat loss. Another is called habitat fragmentation. And that is where, we go in, we take out chunks here and there of wild areas, and all it leaves left is these little pockets scattered about. Which in some cases can actually be worse than the straight up destruction. And that's due to like territory ranges and stuff like that. Invasive species, that's, when a species is considered invasive, when it's brought somewhere outside of where it naturally lives by humans in one way or another, and it starts having detrimental impacts on the local environment. And then, trying to remember, what was the other one I said? Do you guys remember?
Hunting.
It's
pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, that one's really straightforward. That is, a lot of that is unregulated hunting or illegal poaching. Some of it is legal hunting. That's a little bit more of a highly debated topic. But that's the basic background of what's contributing to the loss of biodiversity. And, some people might say, so what, who cares, what's the big deal? And if you don't really value the environment all that much, that's a fair question. But it does provide a lot of issues for people as well. So one statistic that I learned in one of my classes was that about 70% of new diseases are a direct result of biodiversity loss. And you know, you might be asking, like, how does that work? So the way that nature works, you know, everything's in this delicate balance. Every living thing interacts with other living things. You know, wolves hunt deer. Deer eat grass. You know, food webs, circle of life, all that stuff. So the reason that these diseases are coming from a loss of biodiversity is that, you know, like all these animals that have died off, which, by the way, a quick interjection, I said that we've lost 60% in the last 50 years. That's true. We lost 84% in total. So 84% of all biodiversity has been lost in total. 60% in total has been lost in the last 50 years alone. So that's just to give you a more accurate number. You know, but all these animals that we lose, animals, plants, bacteria, everything, you know, they're gone, which means that their interactions with other animals are no longer taking place. And that allows these diseases to spread because, you know, they no longer have predators or animals can't resist them anymore, you know, whatever it is. And one example of that is coronavirus, what we're dealing with right now across the globe. That is a disease that originated in, it's believed to be bats. It may have been another animal called a pangolin, which is similar to an anteater. But, you know, there's that there. HIV is another one. I believe Ebola was as well. But, you know, so there's one reason to care about this biodiversity loss, right? And, you know, there's more like just, you know, the way that in the environment works is it needs these organisms to keep it in balance because, you know, we get stuff out of it too. Oxygen, places to, you know, go. If you enjoy nature, that's something we get out of it. You know, all the natural cycles, food, all sorts of
water.
Stuff. Yeah. Water, air, food, a lot of stuff that we, you know, we need to survive. So I guess question based off of that for you guys, what do you think should be done, if anything?
In regards to the loss of species?
Yeah. Like, what should we do? You know, should we, you know, protect as many species as possible? Should we only focus on, you know, threatened and endangered species? Should we do anything at all? Basically, my last question, but in this, referring specifically to biodiversity loss.
Brayden, you want to hit it?
I'll go first. I have to say again, I don't know a whole lot about biodiversity, but you know, I will say this. I probably say because I don't have a whole lot of knowledge about, you know, certain species and what we should and shouldn't be protecting, I'm going to say that I'm going to leave that up to the, you know, the scientists and the zoologists and things like that, much like how I think our government should do it. You know, I don't think our government should be doing anything that they, because the people in our government, the people who we elect, they are specifically elected because of their knowledge of the government, not because of their knowledge about the about biodiversity or things like that. So I think it's a responsibility of our politicians and of our government to utilize you know, biologists, you know, zoologists, scientists, things like that, in order to make those decisions and to bring them to the government and say, hey, this is something that we think that needs to be done or needs to get done. And then from there you can talk about, I'm going to say this again, you'll probably get tired of me saying this, but incentivizing, right? And that's my thing, though, is that, like, I don't want my government, a bunch of, you know, first of all, whether or not you find them qualified or not is a different discussion entirely, but it's a bunch of people who are educated in government and not educated in biology, okay? And no, I don't think our government should be doing anything directly. What we should be doing is we should be investing in and incentivizing these scientists and these biologists of, you know, whatever institutions or zoos or whatever, to be, you know, to be doing the bulk of this work. And if they find that they need, you know, government aid, and that's definitely something that the government, like our politicians, should be like, yeah, we need to be doing this. You know, that's what lobbying is for, right? That's why you have all these agencies, and institutions and things like that, lobbying certain legislators, and saying basically, hey, this needs to get done. Do you want to do this? Because, like, there will be people who will vote for you simply because you do this. And that legislator will be like, yeah, of course I'm going to vote for that. Or of course I'm going to put that piece of legislation into committee, right? Like, that's how our government works. So that's kind of how I see all that, is like, I don't know enough about, you know, biodiversity and animals and such. So I would say the same goes for our politicians. They don't know enough. Why should they? They are not supposed to necessarily be versed in culturally versed in zoology and biology and things like that. That's just not their particular expertise. What they should be doing is they should be looking towards those who are and asking their opinions and be investing in their work.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to relish this moment because it does not happen often. These next words are very hard for me to say.
Oh, boy.
But I actually agree with Braden.
Yeah!
I agree that the government should not be, you know, in charge of what species should or should not be protected. I feel like that's a recipe for disaster.
Thank you.
However, I could see them using their power to create a task force of scientists with governmental power, you know, to protect them, because people like zoologists and, you know, scientists, whoever needs to be on the board, couldn't, you know, with the government finding people on both sides of the argument to make sure it's fair and balanced, you know, to find the species that, you know, I mean, if there's only 16% left, I'm a firm believer that we should just protect whatever is there. But realistically, you have to be able to give people who are knowledgeable power to make those decisions, which is where I agree with Brady. On a more personal level, I am definitely someone who believes in protecting, you know, what little bit of nature we have left. You know, stuff like the Amazon is disappearing. If the statistics that Ethan was sharing really shocked me, I mean, only having 16% of what used to be a lot more is a very sad number. And I'm all for doing whatever it takes to protect what little we have left.
I will say real quick, first of all, I want to say, Josh, welcome to the dark side. number two, I want to say, I was tracking with you until you said governmental powers to a task squad, because I agree until you said that, because I am a firm believer in the fact that there should be no such thing as bureaucracy. And what I mean by that is that I don't think that governmental powers should be given to anyone who isn't elected or directly appointed, right?
I think I should be a little bit more clear on what I meant. I don't mean like they have the power of the government. I mean the government is backing them to make the
That
I don't mean.
I don't want a committee of 10 scientists being like, "Yeah, you guys can't drink plastic from plastic straws anymore." Like,
no, what? It would be like the government creates a task force. That task force decides on what needs to be protected and what not needs to be protected, and the government carries that out. Basically, delegating the work to experts so that they have accurate information.
Delegation is a beautiful word. Yes, I agree.
That's what I meant by task force.
Right, thanks. Thanks for clearing that up for me, Chief.
Got you, buddy. So, Ethan, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so you guys actually pretty much described how it works right now, at least to my understanding, without really realizing it.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's literally, like, yeah, that's definitely something that I know is, you know, our current situation is that, like, all except the EPA, because certain aspects of the EPA are bureaucratic, and certain aspects are, you know, unelected officials making large decisions, you know, in our government. But for the most part, yeah, that is how it works now.
Yeah, so from my understanding, at least, of how it works is, you know, the government, there are, like, both government and non-government agencies that are working to protect nature and what we've got left. So, for example, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Forestry Services, those are some government organizations. And they do pretty much what you guys are talking. They're experts in the field, biologists, zoologists, botanists. They go out, they do surveys, they, you know, analyze different data and stuff like that. They see what is at risk, what's not at risk, how populations are doing, if they're, you know, declining, increasing, stable, whatever. They go, this one, this species, they're rapidly declining. We need to do what we can to protect them. And then, you know, they'll go in. There's this whole process. I learned about it recently from someone in the Fish and Wildlife Services through my class. So it basically goes through this process. Anyone can do it, actually. But, you know, you go, this species I think should be protected, but under the Endangered Species Act or something similar. And then it goes through this review process of, okay, so what evidence is there that they need to be protected? If there's no evidence, they throw it out. They don't do anything. If there is evidence, they go, okay, you know, how well does that stand? How serious is this? And if they deem it's not serious enough, it's not a big enough threat, they go, it's doing okay enough. You know, it's not declining at a serious rate. And that'd be like, I don't know, there's like a few less individuals every year, for example. And they don't do anything with that one. Yet they do, okay, this one is declining rapidly. Then they either immediately start working on making that a protected species, or it sits on the back burner because there's other stuff that needs to be protected more desperately. To my understanding, that's how it works. That's pretty much how it works right now. I wholeheartedly agree with you that just government officials should not be doing or deciding what we do with the environment and how we protect it.
Brayden, you got a triple Yahtzee.
You know, much like Brayden said, they don't know what they're talking about when it comes to this stuff. It's not their field of expertise. It's just not. Which is why we have stuff like the Fish and Wildlife Service. It's a government agency where this is what they do. This is what they know. They know how to protect it, what to do, what to look for, all that type of stuff. So that's, yeah, I agree with that. One other thing that I think should be done is I think that we should work to protect more natural land, and that we should be trying to restore land back to its natural state. You know, 40% of the land surface of the earth is used for agriculture alone. 40%. Nearly half of the entire surface of all the land on earth is used just for growing food. And, you know, that's it's a good thing we're growing food, but we're throwing a whole lot of it out, and we're destroying a whole lot of habitat to do that. So, I mean, I think it could be used a little bit more efficiently. And I mean, part of that too is not all that land is being farmed efficiently. One thing I believe we should do is work to protect as much land and restore as much land as we're able to feasibly do, you know, while still being able to function as a society. You know, mm-hmm. We can't protect 99% of all land and leave the, you know, 300 million Americans to live in that 1% of land that's left. That's not how it
works. Nebraska.
Yeah.
We'll all move to Nebraska.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we'll all fit there, I'm sure. We'll just have to build 100 miles into the air. Yeah,
what's the build limit on Earth?
200 blocks. yeah, I mean, I don't... That doesn't work. It's just not possible. But I think a good goal is 50% of the land surface of the world we should try to protect. And I don't think that necessarily means federally or state protection. A lot of that can be done on private property, you know. One project I recently had in my class is, you know, taking like your personal backyard and trying to redesign it to be more eco-friendly. Because, you know, just a turf lawn, one species of grass, that's all that's there. Nothing's going to, like, very little is going to live there unless it's underground. So one thing I did in that design is I was like, okay, so something you can do, plant natural and native plant species, flowering species that produce fruit of some sort. And what that does is it provides spaces for these animals to live and reproduce and survive. And that's really important, because honestly, just the federally and state protected lands that we have, it's not enough. They're too small. And I mean, it's not to say that we shouldn't try, because I absolutely believe that we should. I think it's vital that we do what we can to protect, you know, what little we have left.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, just realistically speaking, you know, a lot of protected areas, they just don't have the acreage necessary for certain species. You know, any animal that needs a really large territory, like a herd of elephants, that's a big space. And obviously this would be in Africa or India, but you know, they walk a lot. They eat a lot. They have large territories. A good example of that in the U.S. is mountain lions. You know, they're found just about everywhere in the U.S. I mean, north, south, east, west, the Midwest, they're everywhere. You know, they're in Florida, Texas, Montana, Maine, Alaska. They're all throughout the entirety of North America, honestly. And they travel quite a bit. You know, either looking for new territory, finding mates, whatever it is. But they can't really do that if, you know, it's just these big pockets of protected land. So if, you know, people who privately own the certain lands, if they go, okay, you know what, I'm going to dedicate
X amount of my land to, you know, keep it a natural place with native animals and plant species. I'm not going to turn it into a lawn or a building or whatever. If we do that, it creates these channels, you know, that allow animals to move throughout them in a safe way so that they, you know, they can go out, find new territory, find new mates, stuff like that. And I think that's, you know, a really important way to do it.
Yeah, I think you make some good points in that it has to come down to a lot of people coming together to make choices like that. And I think that's what you were trying to say. It's not going to be just the government. It has to be the people, too.
Yeah, it doesn't work if it's just government. It just doesn't. You know, they can't take everybody's land.
So, Brayden, would you like to introduce your favorite part of the show?
Yes, I would. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is my favorite part of the show. And it is where we, Josh and I, and thankfully today, Ethan, we get to present you with some fire memes.
Another thing I'd like to add in, since this is our environmental episode, I think with our meme, we should also say our favorite animal.
Yeah, let's also say our favorite. Let's also talk about our favorite drugs while we're at it.
Methamphetamine.
Mine's definitely fentanyl, so.
Jesus. Ethan, don't answer.
Yeah, I'd like to not self-incriminate.
Ethan, answer.
No, he pleaded the fifth, bro. We just talked about this.
Fine. All right, well. We're going to go ahead and start with the meme portion, the punchlines portion of Punchlines in Politics. Ethan, since you are our honored guest, why don't you go last, get wrecked. I'm kidding. I'm going to go first. Go first.
All right. So my meme is actually environmentally based.
Shocker.
So, yeah. So it was one that was going around a little bit more a few years ago, but it's a good one, especially, you know, for if you're looking for an environmental meme, and it's the Lorax meme. So my meme is it's the Lorax meme.
Yeah.
It goes like a little something like this. I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. Pollute the environment. I'll break your knees.
Classic.
Oh my God, Brayden, you want to go next?
Yeah, go ahead. All right, so if it's time for me to share my meme, my meme actually features an animal. Look at that. My meme is, you know, its backdrop is the sky with a bunch of clouds, and then the, you know, in the center of this clouds is a frog with a cowboy hat on, a plastic cowboy hat, and the sorry.
I know exactly where you're going.
So weird. I'm sorry. But the top text says not to get political, but and then under the bottom text is just the word beans. So all together, it's a frog with a cowboy hat in the sky with the clouds. And the text says not to get political, but beans. And so that is my meme.
That's actually our topic for next week is beans.
We're actually going to change our name to Punchlines and Beans.
So. Yep. So my meme is actually a shout out to where Ethan and I live right now in Illinois. And it's called The Travel Log of Things to Do in Illinois.
Oh, I can't wait for this one.
And there's actually only one thing underneath of it. So the travel log of things to do while you're in Illinois, and that's leave.
Very good. I was just looking at my treasure trove of memes, and it just so happens I have one that kind of goes along with that. It says, come to Chicago for the food, stay because you got murdered. So...
Oh my God. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this was an extra long episode. Thank you very much for sticking around with us.
If you haven't already, please follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @andpunchlines. Go ahead, follow us, like our tweets, because honestly, our tweets are fire.
Yeah, like you said, we post some really funny stuff, but we also send out updates as soon as each episode is posted.
Absolutely. You guys will be the first. There's really no reason why you shouldn't follow us on Twitter, right? But, you know, other than that, also, we thank you so much for listening to these episodes. If you're a new listener, please go back and listen to our other ones. We swear they're really good.
Ethan's been on an episode before. He did really well on the other one, too, so check that one out.
Honestly, we're amazing. So.
Yeah. We're hoping that he'll come back a lot more now. Definitely enjoy having you on, Ethan.
I have a great time when I'm, you know, on with you guys. Busy schedules, though, you know.
Hey, man. We appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much for showing up again. We always find that our shows are, you know, better when we have you on here. But, you know, wrapping up, we want to thank you all for listening to this episode. Stay tuned for more episodes. They come around probably every other week, honestly, the pace that we're going at. Please stick with us, follow our Twitter account, and yeah, we will be talking to y'all later.
Tune in next week when I give Braden a haircut live. Lordy,
no.
We'll catch you guys next week. Thanks for listening.